This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens. In the entrepreneurial world, the word success can mean a lot of different things. It can mean getting paid to do something you love. It can mean having the ability to make your own hours and be your own boss. It can mean following your instincts down a path that leads to enormous, crazy financial rewards. Well, this week, my guest embodies all three of those definitions and then some. Greg Smith is the founder and chief investment officer of Evolution VC Partners. It's a New York-based culture tech venture investment firm that's focused on companies that, in his words, will change the way we smoke, shop, move, share, communicate, heal, listen to music, and eat. It's a lot of things. And you know what? He's done pretty well with that guiding philosophy. Among his most successful investments is Juul Labs, which he first invested in 2015 when the company was valued at $210 million. Smith purchased approximately 1.5% of the company back then, and today, less than 3 years later, based on Juul Labs' $38 billion valuation, those shares are now worth more than $400 million. Not too shabby. Smith told me he doesn't have an exact formula for picking a winning company, saying it's a lot like that famous quote about pornography. You know it when you see it. But he did tell me what he likes to hear when he sits down with entrepreneurs whose companies he's considering, lessons he's learned from the successes and failures of startups, and offered some amazing advice for people out there who just want to know, how do I get in front of an investor like Greg? I think you'll learn a lot from Mr. Smith. I know I did. And we'll get right into that conversation after this quick word. FedEx delivers millions of packages around the world. But for FedEx, it's not just about packages or pallets. It's about what those deliveries mean for people. Whether it's rekindling a long-lost connection between old friends, a new business opportunity, or providing much-needed hope after a natural disaster in the form of relief supplies, FedEx delivers more than just packages. FedEx delivers possibilities. Find out more at fedex.com/possibilities. So you and I have spoken many times. You've done a bunch of stuff with Entrepreneur. You've been at Entrepreneur Live. But let's just say I don't know you, and we just met at a cocktail party. And I say, hey, I'm Dan. I'm an editorial person over at Entrepreneur. What do you do?
Dan, good to sit down with you today. Good to meet you. My name is Greg, and I consider myself an independent venture investor. I usually joke with people that I'm not a VC, but I fake it as a VC.
Okay.
So that's my cute way of saying that I like investing like a VC, but I don't behave like a VC.
Okay. So how is that different? What does that mean?
Well, I don't have a formal fund. I don't have partners that I report to. I really report to myself and my family.
Okay.
So my wife is probably my biggest boss, as well as my children. But I spend a lot of my time out looking for situations that I'm passionate about, where I want to invest my capital and where I feel I can perhaps get involved and help accelerate the growth of that company.
Cool.
So that's my greatest passion in life.
And how did you, just to get a little bit of your backstory, like how did you wind up here? Did you graduate from college and say, I'm an investor now? Or how did that all go?
Surprisingly, I did graduate from college. I don't know how they let me out of there after a six-year plan.
Right.
But I spent 20 years on Wall Street. So I formerly was on Wall Street. I was an investment banker, worked for a lot of major firms. Primarily, my job was around raising capital for companies in the private market.
Okay.
So my clients were both public companies and private companies that I would get hired to help them raise capital in what would be commonly called a private placement.
Right.
So I probably completed 100, 150 private placements for clients in every sector, whether it be life sciences, technology, consumer retail, aerospace and defense. So I like to joke that I could probably stand at a cocktail party with anyone for 5 minutes and really impress them that I know so much about whatever industry they're in. But after 5 minutes, I have to walk away because I'm done. You know, they'll figure out that I don't really know that much. So I spent 20 years as a banker. All in a way, I had always dabbled in doing venture and angel investing and things on the side. Investing small amounts of money in people that I believed in and that I thought were interesting situations, and just always had a passion for what I call the private markets and angel and venture investing.
Cool. So we met, I think the first time we met was at a meeting with one of the companies that you invested in, Hemper.
That's right.
Who is a subscription service, cannabis-based, and, they kind of... From what I've learned, the thing that kind of separates them is it's kind of this cool branding. The lifestyle of it is not like the Cheech and Chong version of it, but it's a much more modern, sleek kind of cool thing. And so, how did you? You know, you spoke about passion, stuff that you're passionate for. Like, how did you wind up with those guys?
Hemper's a great probably case study on how I like to invest and grow with a company. If I had my wish list, many times I'll start by making a small investment in a company, learning how they behave, how management behaves. Uh-huh. Do they do what they say they're going to do? How are they acting? How are they performing? Are they open to criticism? Are they open to suggestions on how to improve what they're doing and grow? So Hemper was actually a company that I met probably in the summer of 2017. And I had really the luxury of being able to watch them, have dialogue with them, even coach them for probably 6 or 7 months before I actually made an investment. Hemper was unique. They were three 26-year-old, I call them kids, given I have more gray hair than they do, but they're not kids. But, right. You know, three 26-year-old adults that actually had started this company almost out of their dorm room in school. And the capital that I ended up giving them in early 18 was really their first outside institutional funding. What I saw in it was a great deal of passion amongst the three co-founders, the entrepreneurs, a really deep knowledge of the markets that they're operating in. The desire to run through walls for the company and just, you know, do whatever it took to be successful, and to think forward about when I make an investment. It's very easy for investors to write a check, right? It's very easy to go into something. But I think many investors, maybe individual investors or, you know, what might be angel investors as opposed to institutional investors, they're not necessarily looking at what's the exit. So a lot of times, really all the time, I'm thinking about, before I make an investment, what's my exit going to be? Okay. How am I going to get out of this investment?
Right.
I don't want to hear when an investor comes in and I ask them, you know, what do you think is the exit, that they tell me it's going to be an IPO. That could just be the obvious. Just cross that off the list.
Right.
What are the ways that, you know, you as a founder, entrepreneur, and what are the ways you're going to create, you know, wealth for your investors? How are we going to get out of this? So, to me, that's always a very important thing that I think both investors, but more importantly, entrepreneurs, when they're seeking capital, particularly at the angel stage, should have almost a rehearsed answer. They should have an understanding of who might buy them, you know, whether or not that's going to happen. But here are the 10 companies. You know, if I'm a startup travel company, I want to come in and say, hey, you know, there's Expedia, there's TripAdvisor, there's Priceline, there's these serious big companies with, you know, girth that could logically buy us. And then in turn, I'd want to know why would they be different? Why would they be an interesting acquisition target to one of those people?
Oh, okay. So just to take a couple of steps back with using Hemper, I guess, is did Hemper seek out you or did you seek out them? How did you guys come together?
I was introduced to Hemper by a friend who thought it was someone I should meet.
Okay.
And it was, I would classify it was too early at the time I met them in the summer of 17 to be an investable business at that point in time. And as I said, I had the luxury of being able to coach them and work with them to really flesh out and actually improve their business plan prior to me making a decision to invest in them.
So what are some of those, you know, we don't have to speak specifically about Hemper, but just in general, like, what are those markers of this is now an investable company?
I think that there's a sustainable business model there, and I would differentiate, you know, a lot of times as an investor, I'd probably break things down into two types of businesses. There's lifestyle businesses mm-hmm. and investable businesses.
Okay.
So sometimes you will see an entrepreneur that comes in that, you know, they do want to raise capital. They think they want to grow it. But you really have to dig down and understand, is this what I would call an investable business? Meaning, is there going to be or can there be a real exit and a liquidity event for this business? Or is this an individual that is happy to keep this as a private company, have a certain lifestyle, and it's really not going to mature into a high growth situation in which you might see 10x, 20x return on your capital.
Right.
So that's the first thing,
okay.
You know, you might look at, and that's something an entrepreneur has to ask himself.
Yeah.
Do they have an investable business or a lifestyle business?
Okay. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, over the years here, I've spoken to people who maybe thought they had a lifestyle business and then suddenly there was a deal that they just couldn't walk away from. You know, when someone says, I want to give you $100 million for your company, to some people they say, no, it's my company. And then to some people they're like, oh my God, yes.
Yep. No, I've witnessed both situations. In fact, just within the last 4 weeks, I had a company I had been spending months working with that is probably only a stone's throw from your office here in Midtown Manhattan, had been working with, had given them a term sheet, and was going to lead a $1 million seed round for them and work with them and help shape and grow and develop the business. And I think it got to a point in a call with the two partners that one realized they just weren't ready for that outside capital. They weren't ready to be accountable to others.
Right.
They wanted to try and find capital that was, I would call, really dumb money,
okay.
Really friends and family,
yeah.
That was gonna give them the money, no strings attached, not hold them accountable to a growth plan, not give them sort of the serious help that they actually probably need.
Mm.
And in the 11th hour, they bowed out. And
oh, wow.
They said, look, we appreciate everything you've done for us, and this would be great, but we're just not ready for this yet. We want to try and find capital on our own. And then I've had other situations with companies that I thought were phenomenal. And I had one last year that we joked about the travel space before, in the travel space that I really desperately wanted to invest in. And to the point where I gave them a term sheet, we were moving forward. And over a period of several weeks, I just came to the realization that the founder CEO didn't want any help. He wanted to do everything himself. He didn't want any advice. He just wanted capital and to go about his merry way.
Right.
And I came to the conclusion that this just wasn't the right situation for me.
Right.
That I didn't really see eye to eye in terms of the direction of how he was managing the business. I wanted to give him simple improvements from what I call the bleacher seat, having, you know, been around 150 other, mm-hmm. you know, clients before and probably met with 3,000 other companies.
Yeah.
And he just didn't want to take any advice from anyone and was well too set and stubborn in his ways.
Yeah.
That caused me to bow out.
Yeah.
Despite the fact I thought it was a phenomenal business.
Huh. So when you face those situations where it's sort of like an 11th hour, it kind of falls apart, do you personally look at that as like, damn it, or is it like, phew, dodged a bullet?
Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
It might not be apparent at that point in time, but, you know, I'd rather understand. I'd rather not get married to the wrong girl,
yeah.
Right? And you'd rather find that out whether it's at the engagement dinner than after you've walked down the aisle and committed, right?
Right.
So,
right.
It's never too late.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would you say to people who I'm sure there's a lot of people who have this idea in their head and like, They can see it. They can see the whole vision of where this is all going, and they just need some money, and they need everyone to get out of their way and let me do my thing. You know, sometimes there's some benefit to having tunnel vision where you really do have this singular vision, but, you know, a lot of times the outside voice, the person, as you said, in the bleacher seats has a totally different perspective. Like, what's the value there that you would try to encourage people to maybe listen to the bleacher seats every once in a while?
Well, it depends on who's giving the advice,
right?
If it's a institutional or sophisticated investor that's got, you know, a broad portfolio of companies that has done it before, they've been successful, they've seen that movie before, then, you know, there's some valuable lessons to be learned, right? You never want to go to school on, you know, on someone else's nickel, right? In a situation like that, so it depends who's giving the advice. So in the situation which I referenced before, not that I'm the expert, but I've seen a lot of movies before. I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs make a lot of mistakes that might have been able to be prevented. And I also think about business in terms of a game of chess. I'm trying to think about, okay, you're an A round company, an angel round, a B round. What do you need to look like, and how do you need to act and behave when you're going to be a C round or a D round company, right? So there's certain simple things that you could do today to prepare for the future. And if you're unwilling to maybe just embrace some of those, you know, simple fixes, I'm not talking about wholesale change, you know, to a business, you know, then that might be a red flag.
Absolutely. So if I'm someone who has, you know, I've got a business, I've been running it for, let's just say, 3 years, I've got a pretty decent revenue stream going, but it's time for me to grow. How do I take the next step to get in front of somebody like you?
In terms of raising capital? Well, there's a lot of public company databases in terms of trying to find capital. Friends and family is obviously the first layer that any entrepreneur thinks about, because that's the easiest, those are the easiest folks to access and get in front of. And you're going to be the most comfortable making contact.
Is there really any no strings attached money, especially when it comes to friends and family?
You're going to pay for it later if it doesn't work. On the front end, it might be easier getting the capital now. But when things don't work out and it's 10 years from now and you're at the family dinner, you know, hey, what happened to that thing I put money into 10 years ago? But I think the implication is that there's going to be fewer strings attached. There's going to be lesser accountability as opposed to having a third party professional investor, which might have sharper elbows, right? But those sharper elbows could pay off. Because they might be there driving the entrepreneur and keeping them accountable, whether it be to goals, milestones, and helping them move down the field. So back to raising capital, you know, you have many different sources. Start with the friends and family. There's different angel investment groups. In every city, you'll find different angel groups. I happen to be a member of one in San Francisco called Sandhill Angels, which is a group of about 100 tech entrepreneurs and executives that look to finance angel companies that are raising capital. There's many here in New York. So that's great on the early side. But as you start to mature and get to be later stage, you want to evaluate going out to more professional investors.
And, you know, you spoke a little bit before about, you know, your experience with all different types of people in all different types of fields. Is there any value, you think, in when you are seeking money to go to someone who has invested in the kinds of companies you are, the kind of company you're running, like almost like a specialist? Or does that not matter? Do you think that's not a consideration?
That's a great question, Dan. You have many specialist investors that might invest in healthcare, in mobility, in food, in cannabis. They're going to know their sector. They're going to know their industry very well. So on the front end, you have to assume that they are getting a tremendous amount of deal flow, right? They are getting a lot of opportunities brought to them. So they have the opportunity to be highly selective and choose the best opportunities that are brought to them. So if you are so lucky to get capital from one of those funds that is an expert in their field, you can maybe make the reasonable assumption that, well, they've looked at a lot of opportunities and they've decided to anoint me as, well, someone that's good and they're investing in. Now, to fast forward, once they've invested, you also have to assume that if they're an expert in their field, they must have a great deal of contacts. They know what's going on in a particular industry. They know the trends. They know the macro trends, the micro trends. They may even know executives to assist you with hiring needs, right? Many startups, they don't think about the hiring needs that they're going to have. And that's just a major, major problem. I look at, you know, the portfolio companies that I have and hiring, it's we're in a very challenging environment today to hire good talent. So back to a specialist fund, they might know where the bodies are buried in terms of trying to help recruit. And they just might be more value add than maybe, let's say, a more generalist fund that might be just a great brand, great name, but maybe they just specialize in startup. So there's different roles and functions that could come in, but that also goes into the mix of a round, right? You might have various investors in a round, and you might have a mix of great startup investors that have done a lot in different fields, and you might have investors that are, you know, very pointy, if you will, and specialists within your sector.
So you've had all kinds of successes. Is there anyone in your portfolio that's been a bigger success than others?
Well, I would say within my portfolio, the biggest unicorn I've had is a company called Juul Labs.
And I knew that, and that's why I asked you that in that weird way.
So I was fortunate enough to invest in Juul in 2015 when it was also known as Pax Labs. And it was a combination of Pax Labs, which made the number one cannabis vaporizer in the market, and Juul Labs, at the point in time I invested, or the Juul, was only 2 months old and had just been introduced to the market.
So, all right, so Juul is only 2 months old. Again, how does that come to your attention? What did you see in that moment? How did that all play out?
Well, I have to admit that in 2015, and late 2014, I was really scouring the market looking for cannabis opportunities. I had never made a cannabis investment before, and I was looking for a first cannabis investment. And Pax Labs caught my eye. I can't admit that I was smart enough to say, oh, it was Juul, because when I first found Pax, it was early 2015. Before Juul was even introduced to the market. It was then introduced in June of 15, and I never was a direct investor in Pax or Juul. They certainly didn't need my money at that point in time. They had other investors coming to them. They had actually closed a round with Fidelity, who led a $47 million private placement for him, which was probably the biggest telling thing to me. So as I was looking at cannabis investments, and back to what we discussed earlier about exit, what the Fidelity investment said to me in Pax or Juul in 2015 was the following. If Fidelity, the giant mutual fund company Fidelity, is investing in this, this is public market quality. It's saying to me that one day this could have a proper liquidity event of an IPO, and it's not going to have some taint of being a cannabis company and perhaps relegated to going to, you know, the Canadian market.
Right, right.
So that to me was very important. Second, what I looked at was Pax was the number one vaporizer company. The legalization movement in cannabis was in the early innings. It was gaining steam, but we didn't know was a, you know, Jeff Sessions, who I guess wasn't in office, at some point in time was going to wake up and throw everything back to the Stone Ages.
Right.
But I took comfort in the fact that even if the legalization trend reversed, Pax, which made an accessory, a legal accessory, and didn't touch the THC, was still going to be able to sell their product, much in the same vein as rolling papers have been sold for the last 100 years in every C-store in every corner. I like that. And lastly, I looked at Juul as being, wow, there's a nicotine hedge in this.
They're coming to arrest you right now, by the way. I don't know if you hear the sirens out there, but continue, go ahead.
So Juul was what, in my mind, I called a cute nicotine hedge. It was an unbelievable looking product. It was elegant. It was sleek. It had great feedback from the users. I had never tried it. I've never tried it to this day. I'm just not a nicotine user. And I thought it was a great opportunity. It set me on a journey actually in the market of trying to find other investors in Pax Labs that wanted to sell their shares. So I accumulated my stake by buying out other shareholders in Pax. Beginning in 2015.
Right.
And that's how I, the only way that I actually invested in the company, in the secondary market.
And how'd that work out for you?
Fortunately, it's been really the best investment I've ever made.
Yeah.
So I can't complain. I invested in Juul at around a $200 million valuation. And based on the valuation that Altria just paid a few weeks ago, it's now $39 billion. So I got to say it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah. That's pretty
I don't know if I'll have another one of those in my lifetime, I'm very fortunate.
And, you know, we have spoken a little bit about this before. And so Juul, obviously, there's some controversy surrounding it. It's kind of gotten into the hands of people that it probably wasn't designed to be in the hands of. And Juul has taken some steps to combat that. But, you know, as an investor, as you see this kind of playing out in the media and also just in society, like how does that affect you, or do you have any say in, you know, the way Juul handles these situations?
I have no say in the way Juul handles these situations. I'm not an active investor in terms of being on the board, but what I will say is that I think the advent of Juul, it's a tremendous public health benefit. I think this is an incredible reduced risk device. I think it's going to be saving lives. If I were to quote FDA Director Zellner, who I saw recently speak, he said that if every American were to switch to an e-cigarette, we'd save 15 million lives.
Wow.
So I think combustible cigarettes, have we known it, are going the way of the buggy whip.
Right, right.
The next generations of smokers, I wish there were none,
yeah,
but the next generations of smokers are not going to be smoking, you know, our parents and our grandparents' cigarette.
Right, right, right.
So I think it's a tremendous health benefit. If you look at, you know, various statistics and studies that, you know, we'll quote that e-cigarettes are 95% better for you, or, you know, less harmful. You know, I take comfort in the fact that they're doing a good job. Yes, there's been some challenges along the way. I don't think anyone ever intended teens or youth to be smoking this or any other product. I think you look at senior management of the company, many of them have teenage and younger children. I know I have open dialogue with my teenage children about the Juul and about smoking in general. And I think that, you know, we're going to witness them use technology in terms of solving this problem over the coming years, in terms of technology eliminating this from the hands of teenagers.
Right, right.
And I'll also add that, you know, you look over the last 20 years, you know, the teen, or I'll quote the 12th grade smoking rate, is down something like over 70%.
Yeah.
So we're seeing the, you know, U.S. smoking rate hit all-time new lows, which is just a great thing for America.
Completely plummet. Yeah, yeah. So are there any categories that you're, like, really interested in more than others? Or is it like a business-by-business basis?
You know, I look at a lot of different things. I tend to look and like things I can understand and actually have a conversation and explain to my kids over the dining room table.
Yeah.
So really, I joke and call myself a culture tech investor.
Okay.
That I'm trying to invest and find things that are going to change culture and be disruptive to culture.
Right.
So whether it's new ways of smoking, new ways of eating. So I invested in a company called Beyond Meat, which is making plant-based meat.
Yeah.
New ways of traveling. So I've invested in some of the scooter companies like Bird. I've invested in Via, which is a rideshare company here in New York. New ways of listening to music. So I'm looking at things that I can understand. I don't have to have a deep grasp of, let's say, life sciences or biotech or oncology.
Right, yeah.
And go out and be a clinician to really understand, you know, and take FDA risks. So it's sort of like what the Supreme Court said about pornography. To me, I sort of know it when I see it.
Right, right.
So
right.
I do tend to make a very quick decision when I look at an opportunity that I want to move forward and pursue it. And then it's about doing, you know, the deeper dive diligence.
And is your family really kind of like a test audience for you? Do you sort of like bounce an idea of something that you heard off them and see how they react, or how does that work?
I do, and a lot of times they tell me I'm stupid. So I don't know how well that goes over, but it's some investments are out of passion. So
yeah.
I love Via. I ride it twice a day. I ride it to and from work. So to me, that was something that just works.
Yeah.
That's another question I always ask myself when looking at an investment. You know, is there a place in society for this product or service?
Yeah.
Very simple, right?
Yeah.
You know, can this exist in a big way? Do people want this? Is there a need for it?
Right.
So that's sort of a core tenet that I ask myself.
And I would think that anyone listening to this who's, again, you know, coming from the startup side of it, you know, those are questions that obviously people should be asking themselves about their own products. Like, is this changing things? what problem is this solving, et cetera.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, I would say, is the juice worth the squeeze?
Right.
You know, what's the upside? You know, organized or professional VCs are looking for things that can really, really scale.
Yeah.
So I think an entrepreneur has to look at their business as you know, what's the magnitude of scale that their opportunity can present to an investor.
So, you know, you spoke about this before where it might be a great idea, but at the end of the day, if you're not good at communicating that idea or you're not good at working with your potential investor, you might be shooting yourself in the foot. What are some of the big, besides not taking advice, as you spoke about before, are there any kind of like tells for you that I don't think this is someone I want to be in business with? Do you have to be buddies with them? Do you have to feel like you could be friends with them? Like, just what's that like when you're vibing with someone who's pitching you?
I think that I've had the best outcomes with the CEOs and founders with whom I've had a personal relationship.
Mm.
So I will speak to them on the weekend. We will go out for meals and not talk about business.
Yeah.
So we've developed personal relationships. We can go out and have a cocktail. We can relax. And I think that those have been the most genuine and best relationships. I think that you can have more honest conversations. And I think that, you know, I've been able to build a level of respect with each entrepreneur that I've worked with. And I think that if I didn't have that level of relationship, I'd probably be nervous. I'd probably be more shy away from an opportunity.
Yeah. And are you looking for, you know, you spoke about what you are looking for, but again, just to maybe give some people some direction out there, like, are there industries where you're like, hey, if I was going to start my own company, this is the industry that I think has the most growth potential? Is there anything out there that really like screams to you?
There's not.
No.
Sorry, I don't have a good answer for your question.
I'm trying to make.
I got a lousy answer for your question.
Yeah.
I don't. You know, I said, you know it when you see it, and every day I'm surprised by what people have invented. Every week I see a new business that I am just so surprised at the magnitude, the girth, the size of it, of something I've never even heard of before. So it's very exciting to sit in my seat and have the luxury of being able to look at all these great, exciting businesses. Now, it's very hard separating the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really the 1%, you know, that you got to kiss a lot of frogs to find your friends.
Right. So... what about the fact, you know, we talk a lot about taking risks and, you know, not every business is going to work out. So I come to you with an idea. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really float your boat. That's something you're seeing. Am I dead to you now, or I come back to you in 6 months with a different idea and you're open to hearing about it again?
You know, I think years ago, failure was really a four-letter word. Mm-hmm. And, you know, CEOs that failed were more shunned than today, where failure today is more accepted.
Yeah.
And I think people are more open to looking at a CEO or founder that has had some failures before.
Mm.
In fact, one of my most successful investments recently, an investment I made a year and a half ago, the CEO, the founder of the company, he had three prior companies. Two were complete failures. One was a success. What attracted me to it, besides how smart and how intelligent and driven this founder was, but with respect to the two that failed, he never took outside capital. Nobody lost money in it. Not
right.
that was a bad thing, but they were life learning lessons. Mm-hmm. And I'm fortunate I didn't invest in those, but he developed what I see as the most disruptive platform to the car leasing business called Hunker.
Right.
So you can lease a brand new car from your mobile device in just a minute, and it'll be delivered to your door the next day, and all at the best price in the market. And you know, the founder had it one success and two failures, but that didn't scare me.
No, that's. I mean, that I. You know, we have talked about that before, and I hear commercials for it all the time now, and it's such a brilliant idea because I am someone who's in the market for a car, and I'm just dreading going to the dealerships because it's such a night. Excuse me. it's such a nightmare every time. And it's like, you know, the guy breaks out a piece of paper and it's like he's never like sketched out the financials.
Yeah. Nobody likes going to the car dealer. And this is so disruptive because it's going to change the way we lease a car.
Oh, I can't wait for that. So I don't know, we've talked about a bunch of stuff here. Is there any other kind of areas that you'd like to talk about or touch upon?
I would say that I know you have a lot of listeners that are entrepreneurs that are probably seeking capital, and they're probably thinking about, how do I find capital? How do I reach out? Folks ask me this, like, how do I want to hear from people? I would say that, you know, as they're on their journey to raise capital and they're sending these blind emails often to, you know, the ether, they should be, you know, sending short messages about, you know, who they are, what they're doing, what their business is. It's okay to attach a deck. Don't badger who you're sending it to. So if you send it on a Monday and you don't hear back, don't be badgering them on a Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. Give it 2 weeks, give it 3 weeks, and follow up. I can tell you that I do get an opportunity every day to look at. I try my best to follow up with every single one. But I can tell, I would assume that every investor, if something came into their inbox that they were passionate about and they really liked and wanted to pursue, you're going to hear back from them.
Right.
People do get busy.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, if something came in over Christmas break and I was away, yes, maybe it got buried in my inbox. So wait 2 weeks and follow up.
Yeah.
But I got to say, things have come into my inbox, and, you know, from strangers, and I've been passionate about, and I will definitely pick up the phone and follow up.
Okay. So, and then just quickly adding to that, maybe don't send it during Christmas break.
That's maybe a good idea.
Yeah.
Weekends might be okay, right?
Right, yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah. That's fantastic. No, that's great advice, and I'm glad you shared that. So Honker, which I think is an amazing idea, how did you end up connecting with them?
Honker is probably the craziest story in terms of how I found an investment, but it was the spring of 2017. I actually somehow saw the product, which was remarkable because this was a startup that probably had 6 employees and only 10,000 downloads. So somehow I saw the product. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was genius. I had no relationship with the company. It was a startup based in Brooklyn, probably working in a basement somewhere.
Okay.
I went on LinkedIn. I found the founder. I was not connected to him. And I sent him a connection request.
Okay.
I said, hi, you don't know who I am. I assume you're probably looking for capital. I live in New York. I'm an investor that likes to invest in startups. And if you'd like to have a conversation, I'd love to learn more about your business. And that was in April of 2017. I sent it off, forgot about it for a few weeks. And in early May, it was probably 4 weeks later, my cell phone rang and it was the founder.
Oh.
And calling with a degree of skepticism of who was I,
okay.
Which was pretty arrogant for a startup company, you know, that, you know, had, you know, no employees.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later we were meeting and I, you know, to me it was just brilliant. I got it right away.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, there's a place in the world for this product. Leasing a car, going to a car dealer is just a very, to be polite, challenging process. Nobody enjoys it. So to me, this is the Amazon Prime of car leasing.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to be lying in bed at night watching TV, browsing on their phone and saying, wow, a Toyota Camry, you know, 3-year lease, 10,000 miles, click here, it's going to be delivered to my door tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I know it's the best price in the market.
Right.
And I don't have to sit in an office, be hot boxed by a cigar chomping salesman in a suit that, you know, I don't need to go on. I'll be respectful. But it's very complimentary to the dealers and their market. But it's just so crazy looking back that I, as the investor, went and found this individual and that he actually responded to me. So I invested in October of 2017, led a $3 million Series Seed round. I joined the board, got very active in helping them grow the business from a partnership perspective. And within 4 months, we had IAC come in, and Barry Diller's IAC. They made a $23 million investment in the company and led our Series A round. They were the sole investor. So I felt sort of vindicated that, okay, some other, you know, bigger, smarter people than myself also saw what I saw.
Yeah. Do you recall how you did see it before you connected with them?
I really don't, because I was not on a car search journey.
Yeah.
And I think I saw like some teaser floating around of something, but had no relationship with the company.
That's amazing.
And had no ability to get to the company.
Yeah.
So it's just pretty similar to my, Juul journey, in which I saw something I liked and I sort of went out and figured out how to make it happen.
So pay attention to those LinkedIn requests. You never know.
Usually someone's trying to sell you something, but in this case, I was offering money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I am going to check my inbox right after we get done with this.
All right, man. Good.
All right. Well, thanks so much again.
No, thank you. Thank you so much.
This is great. Thanks for coming by.
Awesome.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks.